Choke points.
Let's go.
Signals. You must use them. It's now the law, as established by the Supreme Court itself. And Chris will tell us how this all happened.
Well, I'm pretty sure it was the law beforehand.
It's now even more
lawful.
But now
it's even more the law. Yeah, this happened over the holiday break. So this may have kind of slipped by a lot of you, a lot of folks today. You know, I'm fairly certain that using your turn signal is required by law. I mean, I read the law. I read the law a lot on this. And it says, quote, a signal of intention to turn or move right or left when required shall be given continuously during not less than the last 100 feet traveled by the vehicle before turning.
When required.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Okay.
The driver's manual, also pretty clear. Turn on your turn signal in the direction you are moving. But this was recently challenged in court kind of over that when required because a clever lawyer trying to get his client off of a DUI went, well, if there is a when required, there's a possibility where it isn't required. And he won in several courts in Benton County, up and down the line. That's why it got to the state Supreme Court. So what happened is this Kennewick man was turning left into a left-hand turn lane. Okay, so a designated left-hand, he turned on his blinker, got into the left-hand turn lane. But when he got into the turn lane, as with some of our cars, it clicks off maybe before you think. So it clicked off. He was sitting in the left-hand turn lane with his blinker not on. State trooper came up behind him, pulled him over for not having his turn signal on. And he blew a .25.
So they got him for the
DUI, certainly. But the judge in Benton County said, well, no, he'd already declared his intentions. He'd turned on his signal. He was in the left turn lane. So, yeah, of course, that was a bad stop. There was no probable cause. The state Supreme Court said, hello, the spirit of the law and the law is you need your turn signal no matter where you are going or how you are going. So for all of you drivers out there today, including the three of us, even if you're going into a lane that is a designated turn lane, right, a left turn lane, maybe you're getting off at an exit-only lane off the freeway, and you get in there, you turn your signal on to get in, and it cycles off, you got to click it right back on to stay in. And one of the primary reasons is just because you're in a left turn lane and everybody knows going your same direction, you're taking a left, maybe oncoming traffic doesn't realize that's a left turn only lane or they don't realize your intention. So it's an oncoming traffic safety issue. But
this just sounds like common sense to me.
Well, that's helped me too.
And I was like,
what?
If we're going to talk about signals, I'd really like to advocate for don't turn your signal on as you're getting over, right? Like if you're switching lanes, like there's people like that's how you tell other drivers you're about to do something. So let it blink at least three times, or that rule about the spacing. My driver's ed instructor, who is great, by the way, I feel like I've shared a lot of wisdom from him lately, said the space between two power poles is about 100 feet.
Right.
And that's about the amount of time you need your blinker to be going before you make your move.
And that is actually the law. The law is 100 feet before you make your maneuver. However, at 60 miles an hour.
Hard time. What's 100 feet?
Well,
right?
Think
about 60 miles an hour. Two power poles.
That's less than a second. Maybe just under a second.
60 miles, 88 feet per second.
Yeah, something like that. So, or the 88 feet. Yeah. So they were.
Don't make me do math while I'm driving, okay?
But either way.
Space between two power poles.
Yeah, so the thing that I was. That's why I was accused that we needed a Supreme Court ruling about something that I thought was pretty clear, but apparently a clever lawyer tried to throw a fast one to defend his client.
Hey, what's the law on people having to let you in when you signal your intention?
No, though, you turning on your signal lets them know that they should speed up to prevent you from merging.
I see.
That's what it is in practicality.
Yeah.
If someone is declaring their your job is to, if there is room. Now, obviously, if you're going to jam, so like Colleen mentioned, cut somebody off. No, you declare your intention. The person who is behind you should give you the space to merge over. That's just proper etiquette and proper driving. But yeah, here in Washington, that seems to be, you've declared you want to get in front of me?
This is my space.
This is my home. Get away.
What you're saying is there is no legislation covering that yet.
No, that's just called driver etiquette and not being an hole behind the line.
I don't think that was very bleeped.
All I said was
This is Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross and Colleen O'Brien. I'm Aaron Granillo, and every month we are joined by Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. And Matthew, you are here with a look at the latest numbers on the housing market from the end of 2019.
I do, and Happy New Year to you both.
Happy New Year.
It's a mixed bag in terms of what went on in December. Listings, obviously, the number of homes for sale dropped. Unsurprising, it's December. But the biggest thing actually for me was sales price, and mainly in the single family, not the multifamily market. So if you compare December 2018 to December 2019, King County prices are up by 5.6%.
Wow.
Mm. Snohomish, 8.5%, and wait for this, Pierce County, 9%.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a huge jump for Pierce County. I thought that's where the deals were.
It was. And as we've talked about before, what you tend to see and what you are seeing have really for most of this year is affordability problems continuing to be exacerbated, continuing to grow. And that's actually pushing people further out.
If somebody's New Year's resolution is to buy a home, you know, stop being a renter, become a homeowner, where would you put them?
Several years ago, I'd have said, you know, Columbia City, Georgetown. And if you'd have done it then, you've done very, very well. Mm-hmm. However, they're done and they're gone now. Way too expensive. So I think there's other markets out there. White Center is one. Burien, I think, has got more legs. Mount Baker as well. Parts of Rainier Valley. And so I think there are some which are still have got decent proximity to the job centers, which obviously is important.
But how much time do those places have left before they're further gentrified?
Well, and that's what's going to happen. And it's going to be that ripple effect, which is inherently what you always see. There's a value to our time. We will choose to live closer to where we need to be. Certainly, big story of millennials. They're out there. In my opinion, they don't want to live out in the suburbs. They don't want the white picket fence. They want to have one foot in town and one foot out. But it's becoming increasingly difficult for them now. And because of that, they're actually being forced out into the suburbs. Mm-hmm. They're a massive demographic. They are going to become home buyers, and they are going to move out of their hip downtown South Lake Union rentals and buy them. They are going to get married, and they are going to have children. Less children, but they will have them. And they're going to raise those children in areas which have got schooling, and they're safe, and that's certainly not going to be downtown.
I might buck the trend as a millennial then, because I enjoy the yard. I mean, I think that if I hadn't experienced that in Spokane, being able to have property and a home there, my husband and I would have moved back with our daughter and continued our city life in Seattle. But having experienced the space and elbow room mm-hmm. of the suburbs, you know, and I really found a happy medium with Edmonds because
right.
it's not too far from
right.
Seattle, but it still offers the space of a suburb. So,
and everyone thought they were going to have no babies, right? They're going to be the perma renters. Well, Colleen, you're bucking that trend.
Oh, yeah, I have two girls.
Exactly.
And
owning a home as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a massive demographic really going forward for the next decade or so. So they can be very big. And also understand the fact the oldest millennial turns 38 this year.
Mm.
So they're growing up.
So I'm a millennial and I have a young daughter and I'm a renter.
Ah.
I want to get your perspective on this research by Zillow that just came out recently, because it found that in the 2010s, so in the past decade, $4.5 trillion spent in rents across the country. Just in 2019 alone in Seattle, it was $10 billion alone. So what does that do for millennials who want to become homeowners? Because it's almost impossible to save to then become a homeowner.
Right. And you're absolutely right. And that's inherently been the problem for the last several years. Do I pay my extortionate rent or do I save up for a down payment? Now, historically speaking, it was a little bit more interesting. What did we do? We couldn't afford a down payment. Oh, hit up the bank of mum and dad. and even today, certainly, probably close to half of all millennial home buyers are still going to mum and dad. But mum and dad aren't as enthusiastic to help out anymore. There's a reason for this. And it's tax-based. Mm. And they used to tap their lines of credit or the home equity loans to give money to their children to buy a house. And used to be able to deduct that interest. Well, you can no longer do that.
Mm.
So mum and dad are just being a little bit more thoughtful. Now, if it's a case of lend my son some money to get him out of my spare bedroom, oh, they're still doing it. But if it comes in terms of helping out their renter children buy, they certainly are, but they're not doing it as much as we had seen before.
So who are the home buyers if millennials are struggling to save up enough to get homes in a market like Seattle or surrounding area?
Right. If you look at the numbers I've got of January through November, it's a millennial study, which I look at every month. They're still putting 17% down.
Mm. Wow.
But
that's a lot.
Also, 54% are married. So you've got to think about it this way. All of a sudden, you're bringing in this double income, mm-hmm. double set of savings. They're putting 17% down. They've got credit. Average FICO score is 741. Mm-hmm. So that's a very, very good number.
Good. Yeah.
It really is. So they're out there. They are buying, but it is increasingly hard. And certainly, if you are paying rent, a significant amount of rent, it can be very hard to say, you know, can I save or do I pay my rent?
Mm.
It is a big, big problem. They're just eating ramen noodles instead.
Are you happy to say goodbye to 2019 as an economist?
I am.
And so what are you looking forward to in 2020?
It's going to be a year again of home price growth. My expectation, I look at average home prices, I think we'll probably see King County prices up by 6.7%. Mm. And again, that's 12-month average. Snohomish County by 7.2 and Pierce by 8.1. Mm. So Pierce is still up there. The rate of growth is starting to slow down a bit. Let's say for King County, the last 20 years, we've averaged home price increases across those two decades of about 5.5%. So we're marginally above that, but getting pretty close to the long-term average. I think mortgage rates are going to stay very low. In fact, I think we could likely see mortgage rates drop a little bit, and that's just really given what happened the last few days when it comes to Iran.
How does something like a conflict with Iran affect what you're watching in the housing market?
Sure. Essentially, obviously, the stock market corrected, which it inherently always does when there's uncertainty out there. So what happens when we see a downward push on, let's say, the Dow Jones or the S&P? People tend to take money out of equities and put them into bonds. Safe harbor, okay? Safe investment, can't lose any money, not making much money, but we can't lose. Now, what's important about that is that mortgage rates track perfectly the yield on 10-year treasuries, so 10-year bonds. So as the bond yields go down, if there's more demand, then the interest rate drops. Now, obviously, it's a supply and demand driven issue. And so that then has an immediate effect on mortgage rates. So because of that, it wouldn't surprise me unless we get this thing cleared up quickly, which I find highly unlikely. Yeah, exactly. So I think that being the case, then I wouldn't be surprised to start to see mortgage rates start notching down a little bit over the next month or so.
Chief Economist Matthew Gardner, thanks for the time.
You are very welcome.
It's time for your Daily Dose of Kindness, sponsored by Mike Novak. Enlist with Novak.com. Things could have gone a lot different for a couple caught shoplifting groceries with their kids at an Arkansas Walmart. But lucky for them, Officer Kenneth Martin also happened to be at that store.
We were down there getting basketballs and footballs for the Toys for Tots.
That's out there. Sweet.
And this call came in, I was like, oh, I paid for those. I'll be back to get them.
His body cam was rolling as he spoke to Walmart employees in the checkout line because he decided to just go ahead and buy those groceries for the family. Couldn't bear the thought of those kids going hungry.
Right here. I took care of these for you, okay? If y'all need help, ask for help, okay? Don't do this, not with these babies, okay? All right. I mean, I understand it's food and things like that you need. Ask for some help.
The officer was named Employee of the Month for his act, all captured right there on his body cam.
Time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. Stacy Rost is part of Tom, Jake, and Stacy weekdays at noon on ESPN. Stacy, we got so caught up in celebrating the Seahawks win that we didn't talk about the other wild card weekend contests. In particular, the Patriots lost, so they're no longer in our way. And the other thing is that Tom Brady is thinking about either, well, he says he wants to play until he's 45, right?
Yeah, so he's not, he was asked whether he's considering retiring and said no, not really. So what the real question isn't whether he's going to retire, it's whether or not the Patriots are going to re-sign him because he becomes a free agent on March 18th.
Do you really buy any of that? I mean, he's been successful for the team for so long.
I totally do. Bill Belichick is a cold-blooded man.
Whoa.
Tom Brady didn't have his best season. It might have been one of the worst of his career. No, it's the worst of his career for Tom Brady, so they're still a playoff team, right? But Bill Belichick has not hesitated to part ways with beloved quarterbacks when he feels that they've gotten past their prime. How much of Brady's year was because he didn't have the weapons he's had in the past and the offense really struggled, and how much of it was because of him? Because he still had great moments. So that's really the question that I think people are asking is, does he still have it in him? Because there are other organizations like the Chargers or the Titans, assuming they don't keep Ryan Tannehill, who would probably love to have Brady there.
What would he cost on the free agent market?
Well, right now he's getting $23 million a year, but that would presumably go up quite a bit. I don't know that it would be as high as someone like Russell Wilson, who's getting around 35. So I would guess maybe between 28 and $30 million. Again, you're not going to get a record-breaking deal because you're turning 42. Yeah. So you're not going to get the kind of deal in your prime that someone like Patrick Mahomes is going to sign soon, who could make almost $40 million a year. But I would guess it's going to be more than the $23 million he's getting right now. There's going to be no hometown deal.
Yeah.
Is he less and less of a threat to the Seahawks as the years goes on?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone as they age becomes less and less of a threat. But
didn't they just win the Super Bowl, though?
I know.
It's like he has one bad game and we're like, oh, he's out.
I know. Well, no,
like, come on.
He actually had, not a great season. Like, so as far as just the stats that he normally excels in, they weren't as high. But it's all relative, so it's not good, for Tom Brady. It would be a phenomenal year for anyone else. But again, the Patriots are a tough organization. And I think that it does get harder and harder as quarterbacks age, as any player ages, to be effective.
Okay, the Saints are out of it too. So what about Drew Brees?
Drew Brees is a little trickier because he actually did have his best year with the Saints. So I would anticipate him staying with New Orleans. Maybe it's a short-term deal. Maybe it's kind of like Brady did, where it was just effectively a one-year deal. It would be absolutely insane to see the two best quarterbacks in probably NFL history end their careers with their respective teams on such a sour note. Like, Brady's final play with the Patriots would have been a pick six, and Brees would have ended after throwing an interception and losing in overtime to a sixth seed.
So what are you thinking? Does Brees stay with them or not?
I would guess that Brees stays. I think that the Patriots are run as an organization a little tougher. I think that Brees' most recent year, his connection with Michael Thomas, all of that plays into it. I wouldn't be shocked to see him stay there.
Stacey Rost, our sports insider. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
And on Tuesday mornings, we go live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post. Let's go to the impeachment story, David, because we haven't talked about that in a while. There's still a trial on the way, and the latest development is that John Bolton, former National Security Advisor, now says that he wants to tell somebody his story. He's ready to obey a subpoena. Is that going to happen?
I don't know, actually. There's been a lot of reporters chasing down senators to see if they can find some majority of senators, you know, Democrats plus a couple of Republicans, to issue a subpoena. And the answer seems to be maybe. Mitt Romney and a couple of other folks have said they were open to it. The bigger question is what exactly Bolton is doing here, right? Bolton is somebody who was never just going to give away this information for free. You know, what game is he playing? And I don't think I know it yet.
Well, he's a true believer, right? I mean, but what I read was that he is... He does not believe that Russia has any good intentions and saw this as essentially caving into Russia's takeover of Ukraine, and just he couldn't abide that. And he wants that story to come out.
That very well may be. He also is trying to sell a book. I think he's also trying to give the impression that he wants to do the right thing without maybe ever having to do the right thing. Like, maybe he'll say he wants to testify, but then he knows he won't be subpoenaed. Mm-hmm. And I think this is with Bolton. I don't think anything is ever just straightforward as, you know, he thinks something bad happened and wants to tell the truth. Also, think about what's happening in Iran. This is like Bolton's dream. He's wanted to have a war with Iran for 20 years. So, you know, the idea that he would sell out Trump and take down Trump by testifying against him as Trump is doing the thing that he's wanted to do for his whole life is kind of amazing to me.
So let's talk about Iran. I listened to at least the beginning of Pompeo's briefing. It was clear he was not going to reveal any particular plot that that Soleimani was about to hatch. This seems to be sort of the George Bush justification for going into Iraq. This is a bad guy, and our thinking has now changed, and it's time to take him out. So who do we believe here?
Well, I think it is hard to believe this administration when they say that there was imminent threats, especially now that they seem to be backing off that. Remember, that was the description. You know, why did we kill the official of one government in another country, that neither one of them being America. Well, because he was, you know, it was an imminent danger to American forces. Soleimani was there to, you know, organize attacks on American forces imminently. And you've already heard them backing off of the imminent part. You know, as you said, it's becoming, well, he was a bad guy and we deserve to get him. I think that's really important, because what we're selling is both legally and politically important. It's important for people to believe that we did this extraordinary thing for extraordinary reasons, not because we always hated this guy and we finally decided to take him out. If that's what it becomes, it's going to be so much harder for us to justify to the Iraqis that we should stay there, and that Trump should justify to Americans the pain that we may feel when the Iranians retaliate.
I haven't seen the Washington Post yet today, but I'm told that you have a fact check of a single Trump rally, a fact check that runs for 56 pages, and you conclude, I didn't think the paper was that big. You conclude that 67% of the things that he said were false or unsupported by evidence. And this does lead to a credibility. Well, I'll ask you, does this lead to a credibility problem among people who support him?
No. I mean, I think the people who support him, I don't see any evidence that they have decided not to believe Donald Trump or that he's misleading them. I mean, in part because you still kind of get the magical thinking that we heard during 2016 of, well, take him literally but not seriously, you know, or seriously but not literally, you know, but meaning his supporters know that he's not telling them the truth in some cases, and they still like it because it's such a pleasing falsehood. The question for me is, you know, A, how does it help him in a general election if people have decided they can't trust him? How does it help him in a crisis like this? He's been so lucky to avoid any sort of foreign policy crisis, and here we are in one. And if you go in a situation like that where nobody believes you, or a majority of the country knows that you lie about important things, you know, how do you lead the country in any sort of coherent way when there start to be costs to what you've decided and costs to your falsehoods?
But is there, I'm trying to figure out the other argument here. Is there the possibility that the Ayatollahs in Iraq now realize that this guy is not a paper tiger? He will give the green light on some pretty extreme operations if you push him too far. And that maybe he's just as unpredictable as they have been. In other words, they have met their match here, and they toy with him at their peril.
That is possible. I mean, I think that is the strategic argument for this, was that Trump had been not responding to Iranian provocations for months and months. Remember, there was a thing that happened over the summer where the Iranians attacked Saudi oil infrastructure, and we were about to have an airstrike on Iran, but then Trump called it off at the last minute. Iranians had attacked ships, too. So the idea that Trump had lost deterrence, the Iranians were not deterred, and so then all of a sudden, bam, he does this to restore deterrence. So that now they're afraid to act because, as you said, like, maybe he's so unpredictable he might hit them back really hard. Which is certainly possible. I mean, I kind of worry about that they don't know what to expect, and whatever they're doing is retaliation will cause him to retaliate against them in a way they're not expecting. It's bigger than what they expect. So it is possible. I mean, you have to think beyond just the short term here. What have we done in this situation that makes our position in Iraq stronger, that makes our position in the Middle East stronger? You know, how are we closer to peace and security now? Maybe we've scared the Iranians, but, you know, what's the next step? Where's this leading? And I'm not sure that Trump knows that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the rationale is that Iran is the reason that we have all this turmoil in the Middle East, because they fund all these militia groups that are harassing Israel and active in Afghanistan and all over the place. And that if we finally start, we have tried not responding, as you point out. We have tried not responding. Mm-hmm. So he's going to say, well, maybe we should try responding and see what shakes out. Doesn't that make sense?
I definitely see the argument, and this is one place where I really don't know what's going to happen next. I've read a lot of things about the way that Iran is going to respond, and some say, you know, it'll be a direct military confrontation. Iran will shoot missiles at our military. I've heard of people saying, you know, it'll be an Iranian militia that blows up a bus and, you know, in Topeka next week, or, you know, or blows up a Trump property in the Philippines. I don't think anybody really knows, which is kind of an advantage the Iranians have at this point, that people don't really know where they're going to go. But yes, it will be. It's hard for me to predict now where this goes. If the Iranians think, look, we've now got the victims, the status of victim, we look better than Trump on the international stage, let's keep this goodwill and not respond that hard. Or do they say, look, you know, we have to avenge blood for blood and do something really dangerous?
And do we have the support of allies here? I've heard nothing at all from our allies on this.
I mean, I don't think you've heard them saying that they don't support us, but certainly you're not seeing anybody rush to support us. I mean, even Boris Johnson from the UK, one of our, you know, Trump's biggest sort of allies in the world of Europe, I saw him saying this morning that he hasn't seen the intelligence that led us to a strike Soleimani. He doesn't know why we did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, not criticizing, but just not saying like, oh, I saw the intelligence and I stand with them.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason he hasn't seen the intelligence is that there isn't any, based on what I heard this morning. David Farenthold, thank you.
Thank you.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. And now, here's Rachel Bell on Seattle's Morning News to educate us, as she usually does, about the latest research. And this research has to do with how self-sufficient people are, how able they are to maintain their own homes.
That's right. First, I think it's important to say where the study comes from. It comes from a company called Big Rents with a Z, R-E-N-T-Z. So you know you can trust the study when they misspell the word.
Absolutely.
And probably the founders were drinking a lot of energy drinks when they came up with that. But that's besides the point. So this Big Rent study, which, by the way, they are the nation's largest equipment rental network, they surveyed 1,000 adults about, can you do household fixer-upper kind of projects? And what they found was 2 in 5 respondents said that they are, quote, according to the study, helpless and unable to fix any common household problems without the help of the internet. Mm-hmm. So the kind of problems they're talking about is patching up a drywall, fixing a running toilet. I don't understand this survey because I think more people are probably fixing things at home because of the internet.
Yeah.
If you can watch a YouTube video or if you can Google something and get a manual on how to fix something in your house, that's great that people are actually fixing it and not needing to call a repair person, but they blame the internet somehow for people not being self-sufficient any longer.
That's the theme, because so many people need to go to the internet to learn to fix something. That means that we've become helpless.
That's what it says. It says
isn't it just the opposite? That thanks to the internet, you can now fix things that you wouldn't have dreamed of fixing before.
It was an interesting skew, Dave, on the way that way that they tilted this. So they said that age is a factor. 85% of survey participants over the age of 65 said that they could achieve at least one of these fixes. It was mostly young people, and so what I think that it is more young people are educated and they are working in fields like tech. They're not working with their hands anymore. Right. People aren't working in factories. And so they just don't know how to fix this stuff. And for whatever reason, their parents didn't teach them. I think also because of those professions people are gravitating to, and because the economy is doing so well, people have the money to pay people to fix things for them.
Right.
And things are more disposable now. So
you can't fix anything. You can't fix your car anymore. People used to be able to fix their own cars. Can't do that. You can't fix a radio anymore because there's no parts to solder.
Exactly.
So you just throw out the old stuff and that's the way it goes. Actually, I have used the internet to fix things, which I would never, like when my printer broke, I didn't want to buy a new one. So I figured it's probably just one little itsy bitsy part. Why don't I figure out how to fix it? And an internet video did, and not only did it fix the printer, I felt a sense of accomplishment and pride because I had done it myself.
I had recently learned that back in the day when they first came out with cake mixes, all you had to do was add water. But people didn't feel like they were doing enough, so they started having you add oil and
That's
eggs.
Right.
And then people felt this sense of accomplishment. I baked a cake.
That's
because
right.
even though you use a mix, you still want to feel like you're not so helpless. And so I think it's the same thing. Fixing something, by yourself, using the internet.
Yes.
I don't think anyone feels ashamed that they went there for help. You're just so grateful that there's 10 billion videos on how to find a stud in your wall, which is one of the things.
Well, that's what you take a sledgehammer, smash a hole, and reach around, and the stud's usually either to the left or the right of your hole.
Oh, I totally saw that video that you posted. That was a really good one.
That's how I do it.
Yeah.
I actually feel
I loved that you were wearing the jean short cutoffs and no shirt, by the way.
No, what I do is I bought a package of those, what do they call them? Those white Tyvek bodysuits, that they use for hazardous materials.
Yeah.
I use that for backyard work. Now, I don't have to change into your overalls or anything. Put on a backyard suit, and as long as you got a good fence, nobody can see you. It's really convenient.
I was going to say you probably look like a big fluffy marshmallow.
Yes, I do. But here's the thing: my philosophy is you don't really own something until you've fixed it at least once.
Hmm.
That if you have something that has worked properly and never needed fixing, it belongs to whoever you bought it from, really. But once you've taken it apart, put it back together, and it works, now it's yours.
I guess I don't need to feel that feeling. I would rather it just kept working. I don't need to feel my ownership with my toaster.
No, there you go. That's just the difference between our generations. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Rachel is brought to you by Clipper Vacations. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.